Because for some politicians, maybe if you're a vegan politician, if you're in a more progressive area, it may be more salient, or there might be room for it. What I find surprising is that there is this blatant avoidance, because if it was just not salient, you would see it pop up in like the Green New Deal. It doesn't, right? You would see it come up. To me, the fact that it was so avoided was maybe more a sign that politicians were also worried. Like, not only is this not vote gaining, it could be vote losing.
Hello, and welcome to the Science is Gray podcast, a space where we explore the gray areas and intersections of science, ethics, and social justice. I'm your host, Serena Farb, and as a former science teacher with a biochemistry degree and passionate liberation activist, I believe social progress and justice depend on bringing science and ethics together for a holistic and nuanced approach to creating a compassionate and sustainable world for all beings. That clip you just heard was the brilliant Harvard lecturer Sparsha Saha, who is the only political science researcher studying meat politics from an empirical perspective. Her research looks at how voters respond to political attention given to the environmental and ethical questions around meat consumption and why more politicians aren't talking about meat. This is a conversation we recorded in person last year during my vegan van and speaking tour, and I am so excited to finally share it with you. We delve into all things surrounding meat consumption at the political level, including whether or not the topic of meat consumption is a vote-losing issue, why more politicians don't mention it, and whether or not governments and the elite are really trying to force veganism and fake meats on us. I absolutely love speaking with Sparsha and learned so much during this conversation. And whether or not you are already vegan, just interested in reducing meat consumption, or an animal rights activist, keep listening and you'll learn a lot too. And really quickly before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that if you visit my website, bornvegan.org, you can find more of my work and sign up for my email list to get notified every time I release a new episode. Plus, all the links to my social media pages and YouTube channel are there if you'd like to engage with me more frequently. Well, welcome to the podcast, Sparsha. I'm really excited to have this conversation. So many things I want to talk about with you.
I am so glad to be here. Thank you for having me, and ask away, because this is definitely an issue area where you can talk about so many things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So before we get like into some of the issues, can you just tell me a little bit about who you are and your background, how you got here at Harvard doing what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. So, well, I defended, so I got my PhD from the Department of Government here at Harvard. This was in 2015. I was studying something that I had no interest in. So at the time, I was very eager to leave academia. I thought, look, I'll just get my PhD, get out of here and become a musician.
Okay.
That was the plan. So I actually went to LA. I was lecturing at the School of International Relations on the side, and for kind of just trying to figure out the music scene in LA, which is insane. I was also doing long distance with my now husband, and so I was doing a lot of traveling on the weekends. For many reasons, I kind of realized that that lifestyle wasn't going to be right for me in terms of like a music, like a career in music, whatever form that might have looked like, was just a bit too tricky. And then I also realized that I did actually enjoy research. It was just that I was studying security politics, which in the Middle East, which I think I had just kind of fallen into because my family is from there, and this was something that we talked about a lot, but I actually inherently didn't necessarily have much interest in it. So instead, I started doing a little bit of research for my now co-author, actually, Eileen McDonough, and it was on gender. And I didn't really know that you could study gender and politics. And so I was doing this research for her, realizing it was very interesting, loving it, putting in a lot of time, kind of taking it very seriously. And I think she realized, wait, this person has some good ideas. They are doing some very good research. Why don't I invite them to join me on a project? And so she asked me, and that was the beginning of me going into what's called political behavior, which is okay. the field of political psychology, mm-hmm. not IR. So that's a totally kind of, you can use theories of psychology in international relations, but for the most part, I sort of focused on the American context, and I was within political behavior, studying outcomes in politics related to gender, whether that's how voters react to women candidates or other kinds of candidates. So that was the beginning of it. And I at the time, I sort of was doing this, realizing I was enjoying thinking about identity and wanting to also come back to Massachusetts so that I could live with my then boyfriend. So I just left after 2 years, came back, mm-hmm. and I was fortunate enough to have a job here that worked out. I had kind of kept some relationships with Harvard, and so this job through the writing program sort of landed in my lap. It was perfect. It was in Cambridge, and I was living in Somerville at the time. And at that time, I also had a falling out with my parents. And that rupture, I think, came at a time where I was really trying to figure out what I liked, uh-huh. and what I wanted to do, and what I found interesting. And so much of that had been wrapped up in my parents. I came from an immigrant background. You know, it's Middle Eastern and Indian. It's very kind of like all-encompassing. Your family is you. You are your family. And so this rupture happened, and I was kind of just trying to figure out myself after it, and realized that there were two things as a child that I loved. One was music, and then the other one was animals. And that was kind of the beginning. I started doing some research. I read Carol Adams' Sexual Politics of Meat.
Yep.
That was a very formative book for me. And then little by little, I probably transitioned to becoming vegan over a year. And it's so much more than a diet. It also impacted my work. So I realized that I wanted to conduct research within political science on a topic that would be of use to humanity's need to reduce its reliance on animal-based foods. And so that kind of brought me to my main subfield within political science, which to my understanding, no one else studies, so I'm kind of this loner studying meat politics within political behavior. So what I'm curious about is how would voters react to meat?
That's so interesting. Yeah, there's people studying like meat and psychology and yeah. political science, but I've never heard it yep. framed quite that way.
Exactly, and that material that you're talking about in social and cognitive psychology, those are the theories I use, uh-huh. and I take and I apply them to political phenomena.
Yeah. Very cool. So, like, what kinds of questions are you studying?
Ooh, there's because it really is a new field, and there's not any empirical work other than my manuscript that I'm aware of. There's so many kinds of questions. The one that I kind of took the most direct route. I noticed that despite everything we know about the environmental health and ethical costs of animal-based foods, politicians weren't talking about it, right? Policymakers just didn't want to go near it, really, especially in the American context. Europe, yep. a little bit here and there, but even Europe, there's kind of avoidance. But in the U.S. in particular, politicians were not talking about it. It wasn't coming on to any sort of, there was no political attention on it. You know, I was seeing more and more that the Democrats were bringing environmental issues onto their agenda. And yet there was this giant hole, right, of like agriculture mm-hmm. and specifically animal-based foods as being a huge component of those environmental costs. And they included even things like refrigerant, which I'm all about, you know, list it all. Let's talk about it all. But if you're going to talk about refrigerant and you're not going to talk about meat, uh-huh. That to me is kind of a sign of what's going on here. So political scientists kind of, that question I had noticed had been asked repeatedly in various governmental documents. It was in a WHO report, like sort of like, why are policymakers not paying attention? So I kept on seeing in the scientific fields this kind of like surprise about like, look, we're learning so much from science about these impacts. How is this not on like even being brought up mm-hmm. in the political world. And so I was like, well, I'm a political scientist. This needs a political scientist to answer the question. And I did my research, found out that no other political scientists had answered the question. So I was like, that'll be my question, sort of what explains this lack of attention in politics in the U.S. context. That question needs to be asked in every regional context, because the answer mm-hmm. will differ depending on the particular cultural context and other factors in a country or regional context. So political scientists, when it comes to that question of like, why aren't politicians giving attention to something, they usually take two routes. One is sort of like, okay, is it because it's not salient to voters? That's one answer, mm-hmm. right? And that's, for me, I think that's probably the most convincing answer, that this just isn't something that voters yet have sort of care about.
Do voters care about refrigerants,
though? Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of that was the reasoning I used. I said, well, that's probably going on. But what I find more interesting is to ask, is it vote losing? And is that what politicians are scared about? Mm. Right? Because for some politicians, maybe if you're a vegan politician, if you're in a more progressive area, it may be more salient, or there might be room for it. What I find surprising is that there is this blatant avoidance, because if it was just not salient, you would see it pop up in like the Green New Deal, it doesn't, right? You would see it come up. And I think, to me, the fact that it was so avoided was maybe more a sign that politicians were also worried, like, is this not only is this not vote gaining, it could be vote losing. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to test that. So that's kind of the big question of the paper that I just wrote. But what I'm very curious about testing more in is ethics framing. Mm-hmm. So what happens when politicians approach the topic of meat from different frameworks? The big three right now are like animal rights, environmental, or health.
And I feel like health and environment are the only ones they really talk about when any official, professional, exactly. political setting, if at all.
Exactly. And I think that there's a lot to be said for even the human ethics of this as well. So slaughterhouse workers, mm-hmm. the disproportionate impact on minoritized communities that face pollution from factory farms in this country. So I'm curious about how all of those frames might perform among voters. Mm-hmm. And we don't know. We don't have rigorous testing of these ideas. So I think a lot of times you see... I think politicians making best guesses, mm-hmm. but the information that they're relying on for those best guesses is not scientific. And it may just be a reflection of the loudest voices in the room, which could be special interests, right? It might be that website run by so-and-so person who's being funded by the meat industry. And so the politician thinks, this would be bad if I did this. But is that actually what everyone thinks? And that's where I kind of want to come in and clarify.
That's so cool. So what are the biggest takeaways so far that you've found?
So far, one of the biggest takeaways is that most of the voter backlash, so in the work I did, I ran five survey experiments. And I ask respondents to imagine that there is a hypothetical politician who is giving a stump speech, who's running for president in a primary. And so that was the context for the experiment. And so every respondent randomly either read the treatment speech or the control speech or the treatment speech. And one of the treatments included a paragraph linking meat to the environment. Mm-hmm. I picked up some voter backlash. So if a national level politician does put political attention on this, there most likely will be some backlash, but it's mainly on the right. So, and that's not a big surprise, right? Uh-huh. It's meat and then it's the environment, two things that right-leaning voters are not gonna particularly be drawn to. The backlash that I pick up on the left is very, very small. Hmm. And actually among strong Democrats, there's no backlash at all. So what this tells me is that maybe there is learning that's happening on the left, very similar to how the left learned about cars, right? So that mm-hmm. was a learning process as well for the left to become more comfortable with the idea of linking transportation to climate change and having policies to kind of handle some of those emissions, which occurred through the EPA. So I think that this tells me that over time, politicians may find, if not success, they will not be punished. In the West region, there is no punishment for bringing up meat and linking it to the environment.
In the West, like Western...
West Coast.
Of the U.S.
Yeah. Okay. So this includes, I believe, Arizona and some of the other states on kind of that part. But when I broke it down into regions, the West was sort of by far the most progressive on this issue and did not punish the hypothetical politician. So Democrats, I think, can bring it up now. And even more so as time goes on. So this was a sample that I ran now 2.5-3 years ago. Mm-hmm. It might have changed since then. So if I were to rerun this experiment, I would not be surprised if I didn't see any backlash from the left at all.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think the left is ready. The right, the environmental frame, as we might have guessed, is not the right one that's gonna uh-huh. work. But the other takeaway, which was very interesting, was that animal rights performed really well among voters.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, in the vignette experiments, there was no backlash if the politician linked the need to reduce consumption to the need to protect animal rights. So that did not face any backlash from the left or the right, which I found very interesting.
Yeah.
So this could be an area of collaboration between the parties on a particular issue. And then when I ran conjoint experiments, I found, which is a different kind of experimental setup where you can manipulate a lot of characteristics and still measure or isolate the effect of a variable, changing a variable on the outcome. And this one was interesting because it showed that for the left-leaning voters give a bump to women of color. This is specifically Black women and Latina candidates who are running on the left for president. They get a bump from voters for being personally concerned for farm animals. So the reason for that could be related to many different things. It could be related to stereotypes about Black women or about Latino women. Another possibility is that voters are more friendly to this topic coming from people of color. So there's more to explore there. But that, to me, said that maybe we are ready for some kind of moral leadership on this at the national level.
That's so fascinating. Yeah. So, okay, one of the things this makes me think of as someone who's interacting with lots of different people, talking about veganism and animal rights, you know, in a lot of different circles, increasingly in the last, you know, year or two, I've found a lot of people that will say things to me like, you know, the elite and governments, the World Economic Forum, World Health Organization, UN, they're pushing fake meat and eating insects on us or pushing veganism on us, you know, and this is kind of something I'm hearing from people as like why they don't trust or are rejecting, you know, veganism. So I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts on that? How would you respond? And, like, do you think are governments actually pushing veganism on us?
No, governments are very much not pushing veganism. I believe an argument could be made very convincingly that they actually push animal-based foods on us. This is simply because there, across many countries, and also true at the international level, there are subsidies that keep meat well below its true costs. So just in the U.S. alone, billions of dollars have been spent. A hamburger, right, that you get from Burger King costs $4. It should probably be closer to $12 to $14 if we actually put in the real costs of producing it. So we could get into the weeds easily, but even so far as sort of giving land so cheaply in the Western Range or in the kind of in the middle of the country to ranchers for cents, the price hasn't changed from decades ago, right? So everything from land to feed to regulations and policies, the government actually makes it very easy for cheap meat to exist. And I think that there is a lot to be said for the oppression of non-humans as central to the very kind of like foundation of liberal democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Liberal democracy was actually also, the development of liberal democracy involved a process of kind of commodifying non-humans as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So where, you know, so like you said you picked up with the environment some of this, you know, backlash on the right. Where do you think this is really coming from, or why do you think there is this backlash of, you know, governments or institutions pushing this on us?
I think that, I mean, there's, I think, different reasons. So on the right in particular, I think there is an aspect of this when it's linked to the environment that has to do with more general environmental attitudes, which we know from a lot of research now, there is a strong global left-right. So if you are more left-leaning, you tend to generally have more less anthropocentric environmental attitudes. You tend to be more environmentally concerned. And if you're right-leaning globally across countries, you're less environmentally concerned. We think this has to do with many different things. It could have to do with your preference for hierarchy, what's called social dominance orientation, which is higher among right-leaning people than left-leaning people. Could have to do with your preference for authoritarianism, which could, you know, sort of get, why is the government being involved in environmental, right, that kind of thing. So there's an aspect of this that's related to an individual's relationship to nature, which is mediated by their party affiliation or by their ideological leaning.
Okay.
So that's one part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part is also just related to meat attachment. And so from a lot of good research, we also know that this varies along with your partisan affiliation. So if you're a Republican, if you're more right-leaning, you have higher levels of meat attachment than if you're a Democrat. You tend to have lower levels of meat attachment. So the backlash, right, connecting the two would be higher from right-leaning folk.
That's so interesting because, I mean, this is just my anecdotal personal experience, but when I was in college in Iowa, I was a senior, 2016. Bernie Sanders came to speak on our campus.
Yeah.
And I got picked to ask him a question.
Interesting.
And I framed it. I thought about how I wanted to frame it, you know, and so I didn't ask him, like, does animal agriculture cause, you know, climate change, environmental issues? I was like, given that the science says animal agriculture is responsible for, you know, I don't remember exactly which number I went with at the time, but I framed it like that, and I said, you know, what do you plan to do about this then? And, like, he completely
dodged it.
Was like, climate change is a big issue. Yeah, we need to have electric cars. And I was like,
wow.
So it's like, I find it so interesting that you're saying, like, the left is more open to a lot of these things, when, like, my personal experience has been they're not as bad in different ways, you know, different arguments. Yeah. But, like, they seem pretty attached to meat consumption as well.
No, they absolutely are very attached. I do think that some of this sort of just gets at, like, general human cognitive dissonance around meat, right? That there's a discomfort with talking about it. There is honestly, some of this might even be related to the perception of people who care about animals, right? And I think some of that damage has probably been done by the animal rights movement itself, right? So I think there's all of those kind of things going on underneath it. But the other thing I would say is that I think that politicians have kind of been especially on the left, I think they've been kind of walking around thinking, assuming there would be backlash. But I think that the left is changing when it comes to meat, and I wonder if the public's ready to start talking about it legitimately on the left.
That's, I hope so. Yeah. That would be very cool. Do you think that there's any place or potential for, you know, third parties like the Humane Party or anything like that?
In the United States, I think that there's a whole literature on sort of what the importance of third parties, that sometimes they can do damage, sometimes not, right? They can push parties in different ways. But since we have such a strong two-party system, a serious impact, right? Like winning an election, I think, is very unlikely.
Like for pushing the discourse, even.
I mean, from, I think 4 years, I think there was actually a candidate. He was, who ran from the Humane.
Clifton Roberts.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right. He ran. That's such a good question. I hadn't thought about that a lot. What sort of I think it's good. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. My advice would be, instead of trying to shape the conversation that way, I would encourage animal rights activists to think about running themselves at the local level.
That's such a good idea. Yeah. And local politics have such a bigger impact than most of us 100%. Realize.
It's also a pipeline to higher levels of office, right? And I think this is one of those areas where if you have candidates who are doing a good job and they're also bringing animal rights into that conversation at the local level, where I bet there would be a lot of support for starting to bring this in to a topic, I could see that being an entry point to the issue. And I think it would have more impact to do it that way than as, at the kind of third party level. But that said, I mean, I would have to think more about it, but I don't think there's no positive impact from that either.
So what about just this idea of, like, systemic change in general? What do you think, if your research has touched on this at all, like, if, besides politicians just talking about these issues, like, what types of legislation or policies are you actually thinking?
I think that it's too early to talk about specific policies and specific legislation. I think that this is actually one of the problems that I see in that, like, industry, like the, like, when I look out and I see reports on this issue, kind of like, how do we get legislation? How do we get this done for animals? I think it's jumping the gun. I really do. I think the focus right now should be on shaping, trying to shape norms. So, and the reason for that is because before you can even get legislation to meaningfully happen, you need political attention on the topic. You have to have candidates who legitimately can break what I call an animal taboo. So at the level of politics, there's this taboo. You don't talk about these beings that mean so much to most of us in our lives, right? It's kind of a bizarre taboo, but it's just not brought up.
I get told routinely, you know, talk about the environmental and health. Don't bring up the ethics, you know.
I hear that too. I hear that too. And I kind of push back against that, because I think it's about everything. And if we're censoring ourselves and we're not bringing something in, I think we're kind of missing the point. But more so than that, it's ethics that has the ability to shape norms. And the one of the tricky things about meat and about animals, farm animals, is that there are very, very, very strong negative descriptive norms. Meaning, when you look around, you might have just watched Dominion, and then you see your friend grabbing a steak, right, at lunch. So everybody eats a lot of meat a lot of the time in the U.S. So that's a very strong negative descriptive norm. And we know that what that hurts is the development of a positive prescriptive norm, which is, we should all eat less meat, we should be, or no meat, we should be thinking of this as a justice issue, right? So that strong negative descriptive norm is inhibiting the development of a strong positive prescriptive norm. One solution to this problem is to actually encourage a top-down process of shaping norms, where you have key leaders. These can be social leaders, business leaders, economic leaders. It doesn't matter what kind of leader. But you have key leaders who
start talking about it up here in legitimate spaces, right? Because what that does is it can help shape a sense of, ah, this is something that we can talk about, A. And then also leaders enjoy what's called an innovation credit. So it's likely that if a leader is bringing up this issue, I think gender and race matters here for this. But if they're bringing up this issue, they might avoid backlash, which at the individual level, vegans and animal rights activists have reported facing. Uh-huh. But at the leader level, I think there's an innovation credit possible, which means that they can avoid backlash. And in some cases, this can actually benefit them because they'll be seen as a kind of cutting against the grain.
Right.
Right. And that can benefit leaders sometimes. It's called a deviance credit. Uh-huh. And leaders enjoy it. So actually, I think the focus should be on non-vegan leaders to legitimately bring up these issues in mainstream spaces to start shaping norms from the top down. So for instance, like the Pope, actually, I'm not Catholic, I'm not religious, but when the Pope came out and said we should be reducing meat consumption, actually that was a big moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. It's kind of, I don't have any research to back this up, but my personal feeling has been, you know, things like the campaign to ban meat in Berkeley or something like that are too soon. Like, this is part of why I focus on education.
Yes,
I feel like
there's
more likely to be backlash. Like, if you have government officials, police officers, all the people enforcing, you know, the laws don't support the laws they're enforcing, then that just doesn't seem effective to me and you know, likely to lead to black market type of whatever.
Exactly. Yep. No, I think education is a key part of this, right? Like, you could have all the norm shifting you want at the leader level, but people have to be ready too,
mm-hmm.
right? So those two things actually go hand in hand. It's a top down and a bottom up, right? The bottom up is that education part. The top down is to see key role models
mm-hmm.
talking about this legitimately so that we all feel comfortable. Like, how many times do you go, well, I mean, this, you are braver than me, but I've been in so many situations where, you know, I teach a course at Harvard on this
mm-hmm.
and I'm in a family environment or a social environment and there's tons of meat being eaten around me. And I kind of, you know, I feel that if for me to bring up the topic that I care about the most in the world would be inappropriate,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's a problem. That needs to go away, that feeling.
Absolutely.
Because it limits the impact that vegans can have on non-vegans mm-hmm. when we have that fear of backlash.
And I've had that too for all that I've done. I feel it as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of social pressure out there to not be that vegan, not be that annoying person, you know, when it's a justice issue. And
Totally. I went through like an angry vegan phase on my, now I'm not on Facebook anymore, but I was very active.
Uh-huh.
And I was always kind of putting out research about environmental effects, research about health, about ethical issues. I was doing all this learning about what the industrialized factory farm process was like for animals. And it was just facts. It was always me kind of saying, well, I learned this and I would talk about it. And I think that had a really negative impact on my work, actually.
Mm, really?
Because a lot of my friends were friends from grad school who are now in academia. And many of them kind of stopped talking to me. Many defriended me. You know, I see them around campus now and they ignore me, right? So I know that they, you know, they quote unquote lost respect for me.
Uh-huh.
And these were people who I knew and I was friendly with. So that was hard. But I also kind of have this attitude of like, whatever. But I think it did hurt my career.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up here, is there any last thing you want to say? And then where can people find you or learn more about your work or support you?
Aww. So I'm on LinkedIn and I have a Twitter. It's just my name, Sparsha Saha. So I will pop right up if you search for me. So people, you're welcome to follow me there. I kind of focus on putting out information that I find very interesting. So that's kind of what you'll get from me on those forums. But I think that this new, I'm sensing more and more this kind of new guard of, like, let's not bring up animal rights. Let's not talk about it. Let's focus on just environment and health. And I think this new guard thinks this because a lot of them came out of the animal rights movement. Like, they worked for some of these organizations, and they feel that it was ineffective. But I think we're in a different place now. And I think that the new guard, their sensitivity around bringing up animal rights might be misplaced at a very important key time when we actually should be really kind of pushing forward with it. So I would say that if you're out there and, you know, ethics was what motivated you, don't push it down because, you know, you think that you have to be more strategic about it. Don't push it down. There are ways to talk about it. You know, I had an angry vegan phase. There are ways you can kind of, like, inoculate yourself from some backlash. But I think that we need more moral leadership now more than ever. And for me, that involves ethics.
Absolutely. That's beautifully put. And thank you so much. Yeah. And we'll have to talk about the Plant Futures Initiative and everything you're doing with that.
Part two. It'll come.
Another time. So stay tuned.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks so much for listening today. And if you enjoyed this episode or are enjoying the podcast as a whole and want to support me and help get this information in front of more people, I would love it if you could share this episode and also leave a rating and review of the podcast in the iTunes or Spotify app or wherever else you are listening from.